First of all, thanks very much to Tom, both for acknowledgement and welcome to country, and for the opportunity to come and speak with people today. Two things that I want to do is, one is to provide a bit of a context and background to the Northern Territory, because I think that's incredibly important to understand first, so then you can understand about what some of our concerns are with respect to this federal government's intervention. One of the things in particular about the Northern Territory, and I guess it's probably been not too widely recognised, is the rate of population growth, very rapid population growth, particularly in remote communities over the last 20 years. The latest ABS census suggests that we've had a 40% increase in population out bush in the last two decades. As many people would be aware, Aboriginal people make up about 30% of the Northern Territory's population, about 12.5% of the national figure. The most interesting and perhaps challenging statistic there, though, is that nearly 40% of the NT's Aboriginal population are children under the age of 15 years. The other particularly interesting characteristic about the Territory, again, which is distinctly different from any other jurisdiction, and that is the sheer numbers of discrete Aboriginal communities. By far, the most discrete communities in anywhere in the country. We have 9 towns with populations of nearly 2,000 people, and in some cases I'd suggest more than 2,000 people. 50 communities with populations of between 200 and 1,000 people, but 570 communities with populations of less than 200 people. And the reason why I highlight some of these statistics, if you like, or the geographic location for Aboriginal people, is that I want to acknowledge first and foremost the difficulties that that presents by way of a challenge to governments to deliver services and programs to many Indigenous Territorians. Because well over 72% of the NT's population lives outside the major urban areas. So the vast majority of Aboriginal people live on Aboriginal land, away from major centres like Alice Springs, Catherine, Tennant Creek and so on. And needless to say that the vast majority of Aboriginal people, therefore, do not have good access to services. Let me just see if I can scroll this down. God. Crazy. Hang on. Sorry, bear with me. This is just a bit of a map of the Northern Territory, which shows you the geographic spread and location of remote communities. It's not a particularly good map, but at least it gives you some idea of what I'm talking about. The characteristics of discrete communities, I guess, is probably fairly well known to most people, but other than to say that they're geographically dispersed, isolated, and quite often across northern Australia subjected to seasonal factors such as very heavy wet seasons, which makes our communities even more isolated, and difficulties arise in terms of access. So for about 6 months of the year, many of our communities can be cut off by road. Given that this whole intervention was supposed to be targeting child protection and the well-being of children, I just thought it was interesting to go back to the ABS census data and to have a look at the availability of various services and infrastructure that might go to the heart of protecting kids. And central to that, of course, are things like women's refuges, childcare centres, single men's accommodation and single women's accommodation. And in all of that, what the data currently tells us is that less than 6% of our communities have things like childcare centres, 2% women's refuges. Only 2% of communities have anything to do with single men's accommodation, and again 4% of communities have anything that might provide single women's accommodation. I've also pulled together just a very quick snapshot of some key health data and health statistics, because again I think they're worth sort of having a look at. Access to a local health clinic. 54% of our communities don't have any access to a local health service. But more astonishing, and probably not to some of us, but 99% of our communities have no substance abuse services or programs. So quite clearly, the things that we've been saying for a long time about the need for additional services and programs, I think this kind of paints a much better picture. I've included in here also the estimated costs for things like managing chronic disease, such as end-stage renal disease. For people who go on to dialysis treatment, it costs per person or per patient per year something in the order of $100,000 a year. In every one of our major towns now, we now have renal dialysis units, and so you'd have to ask the question, why is it that as a country we continue to spend money on high-cost tertiary services where there appears to be very little investment in primary healthcare, a la, you know, the comments I'm making about access to local clinics. The underlying causes also of chronic diseases that Aboriginal people face across not just the Northern Territory but across the country are largely underpinned by things like poverty, disadvantage, incredibly poor living conditions, including things like low birth weight and poor nutrition. I guess none of this is new to many of you. I'll get through this really quickly, sorry. Education. Given that this again has been sort of a high priority for governments, both federal and territory, about getting improved outcomes for Aboriginal kids, and yet 94% of our communities have no preschools. If you think about that just for 1 minute, I mean, it's taken as an absolute given that if you want to get good education outcomes for kids, then you've got to actually provide the right foundations. That is early childhood learning and certainly preschools. The other shocking statistic for the Northern Territory, and it's something which causes, I think, all of us enormous distress and alarm, is that nearly 43% of secondary school age students in the Territory are classified as ungraded. That is, that year for age, they don't even reach school attainment levels. So many of our secondary school age kids would have the equivalent of a year 3 or 4 standard of education. We've got the lowest retention and participation rates for education across all jurisdictions. So again, I'd strongly make the argument, you know, there's hardly any point quarantining people's incomes in order to make kids go to school if schools themselves can't cope with or provide the kinds of programs that kids need. Housing. We've been banging on about this one for as long as I can remember. But despite having said it for the last 20 years and constantly saying how bad our accommodation needs are in the Northern Territory, I don't think anybody really pays any attention to it. Hence having to resort to put it into graphic format, because I think that's the only way we do get the message across. But as you can see, the figures shaded in sort of blue or purple there are figures from 2002. The reddish coloured figures are 2004-2005. So almost in every jurisdiction there has been, well, I wouldn't say every, but most jurisdictions, there's been some sort of marginal improvement in reducing the levels of overcrowding. However, in the Northern Territory, the rates of overcrowding remain shockingly high. And if you just care to think about what that means at the moment in the context of this NT emergency intervention, if you're trying to protect kids from child abuse or any kind of abuse, then I'd suggest reducing the rates of overcrowding and stress on families and housing might be a good starting point. These are current estimates of the Northern Territory housing that says that we need an additional 5,000 dwellings over the next 3 to 5 years. And it's not just simply a case of providing the extra housing, because in most of those communities we don't have available serviced land, that is, service sites with power, water, sewerage, etc. on them. So the figure for the housing needs has got to include the infrastructure costs, and that's why it takes it up to something in the order of $2.5 billion. Unless we get serious about addressing some of these problems, the so-called emergency or the crisis isn't going to go away. This is a map that was taken from the Productivity Commission's report on Indigenous funding. This goes back a number of years ago. But the areas shaded in red were the areas deemed by the Productivity Commission to be the most disadvantaged in the country. It includes, and I would argue too, that despite Alice Springs and Darwin being sort of excised out of that map, I'd say today probably Alice Springs would be included if you took into account the rate of population growth, the lack of available public sector housing, and just the general level of need. The areas shaded in the darker brown sort of come in second order, and then followed by the sort of, whatever that colour looks like up there, probably a khaki or an olive. But quite clearly what it shows is that the entire Northern Territory is really lagging significantly behind, you know, that of other jurisdictions. All right, I'll get out of here and then I'll... God. I think I ought to get somebody to drive this for me. Get it there. Sorry, I'll come back to the PowerPoint presentation now. No, wrong one. Okay. Now, where am I? Slideshow. Sorry. That one? Good. Ah! There we go. Hang on, I've got to go back. Okay. Just as a very quick overview, I've already just done the NT context, and I'm sorry that wasn't actually on PowerPoint, it might have been a bit easier. What I wanted to cover off very quickly was some of the core elements that's contained in this sort of emergency intervention response and what's in the bills generally. That's a list of the issues that I'll touch on. I wouldn't worry too much about taking notes because, I mean, you'd be welcome to have copies of the PowerPoint if you want. Just touching a bit more on the Northern Territory context, and I think that, again, this is really important to note, is that the Territory is characterised by, I think, a very large number of short-term residents to the Territory. A lot of that has to do with the sort of nature of the Territory being seen, I guess, as a bit of a last frontier. People come there to make a few bucks and then go again. But we have an incredibly high turnover of that non-Indigenous population between one election cycle and the next. And the latest figures seem to suggest something like a 40% turnover in the voting population. But what that actually means is then for many non-Aboriginal people who come to the Territory, they either have a very limited understanding or none at all about Aboriginal people or remote communities. And what's more, they don't really have a long-term interest or commitment to the Territory. And I think that also impacts and influences then the way in which the Territory governments, and I mean current government and the previous ones, the way in which they've pandered to that non-Indigenous sector, if you like. Because elections are won and lost largely in Darwin. So if you've got a population that's turning over at a rate of 40% between one election and the other, you're sure as hell not going to spend a long time as a politician explaining the complexities of Aboriginal affairs. You've got all of that. Yeah, okay. The legislation. There were 5 bills in total, one which was a totally new bill, the Northern Territory Emergency Response Act. The other two were the Social Security Act and the FACSIA legislation. They were amended. And the last two were appropriation bills or the money bills. Funding. When we first heard this announcement of the intervention and that there was going to be a significant investment of nearly $500 million for this emergency measure, I'd have to say, you know, we were sort of cautiously optimistic. We really did start to think that this was the beginning of a new commitment to the Territory about meeting some of these backlogs. However, during the course of the Senate's Legal and Constitutional Committee and hearings that were held in Canberra over one day, it was made pretty clear that a lot of this money was actually going to be consumed by creating a new bureaucracy. There are 700 new positions to be created. These are all new public service positions. I suppose most people have sort of heard about that, but I'm just absolutely staggered that you could possibly consider we need a new army of bureaucrats, 700 people, to administer this stuff. This is mind-boggling stupid. Out of that 700 new positions will come 300 people who are Centrelink contract managers, if you like. And for the very first year of the quarantining of incomes, the government's planning to commit something like $88 million to manage the income of less than 20,000 people. I mean, are we real in this country about addressing Indigenous need? Because I don't think so. When governments can spend money like that, I mean, it's an absolute disgrace. The legislative measures are intended to last for 5 years while longer-term approaches develop. Now, again, I'd have to ask the question, why would it take you 5 years to work out a longer-term approach, given what we already know and given what we know that we need and given what we already know about what works? So what does the legislation do? Essentially, it goes to the heart of things like the acquisition of land and other property, and by property I mean assets, changes to the permit system, management of communities, which is currently now being badged as governance, the quarantine of income and other welfare support or other income support, the management or registration of community stores, the sentencing in terms of criminal law and bail for Aboriginal people, alcohol and pornography. So where does it apply? And it's a pity I don't have a map, but for most of you, and I perhaps should have said this as well, that almost half of the landmass in the Northern Territory is subject to the Land Rights Act. That is that we own almost 50% of the landmass in the Territory. So it will apply to Aboriginal people living on all of that Aboriginal land. So it's the Ulra Land Trust communities of about 47 communities. Community living areas. Community living areas are very small sort of excisions, I suppose, or pockets of land, mainly on pastoral leases that had been excised and now come under Aboriginal control. It includes all of the town camps across Darwin, Catherine, Tennant Creek and Alice Springs. The five-year leases. There's been a fairly clearly planned out phased or staged approach to the commencement of this. But the other thing that's interesting to notice is that other communities will be added or included. And for those of you that might have read the article in the Weekend Australian talking about rolling out similar sort of quarantine of incomes in South Australia, clearly this was conceived some time ago. I also had I suppose it was sort of a gut feeling that perhaps it might have been intended to imply to suburbs like Palmerston, which is a satellite suburb of Darwin. It's an area characterised by low socioeconomic profile, large numbers of Aboriginal people there. The leases. Freehold title remains with the traditional owners during the course of this lease, but the minister has the right of exclusive possession. The minister will control and decide who can live in those communities under these leases, and the minister may decide whether or not they do or do but don't pay rent. It's entirely his decision. If, however, during the course of these five-year leases, people voluntarily surrender their ownership to land and willingly sign up to a 99-year township lease, which is what's been on the agenda for some time, then the five-year lease will be suspended or negated. And the other critical point to note, of course, is that native title rights were suspended during the period of this 5 years as well. Compensation. This is where it gets really interesting. Almost in any other jurisdiction, the payment of compensation, if your property is compulsory acquired by the Commonwealth, compensation would be payable. Given that we're a Northern Territory or a Territory and under the Constitution, it says that compensation isn't payable as a Territory. But even if that wasn't the case, just to make absolutely sure, they've amended the Northern Territory Self-Government Act so that it says that compensation isn't required unless the Constitution, unless the High Court determines that it is. And perhaps Sarah might talk some more about it. But basically it's saying that for this class of people, Aboriginal people, whose property rights will be acquired, there's no requirement to pay compensation. Governance. This was the stuff that I was talking about in terms of community management. It's all fairly self-explanatory, I think, but this is really worrying a lot of communities in terms of the appointment of the government business managers. I think there are 10 already that have been deployed and placed on the ground, with about another 36 to follow. Those business managers will have absolute power and control of micromanaging the affairs of the entire community, not just Aboriginal organisations. It comes down to other service providers and other entities as well, and I'll get to that a bit later. The Minister is able, through his delegate, to provide directions to entities delivering government-funded services. So it applies also to the NGO sector. And for many of our communities where church groups have had a long-established relationship where they provide a range of services, I'm taking it to mean that it will include those organisations as well. Again, they'll be able to provide directions to the entities to perform specific tasks or actions, or to desist or to refrain from them. There'll also be the ability to appoint additional external managers to community government councils. Community government councils, by the way, are our local government organisations, but it also is extended to other incorporated bodies too. The idea that you can appoint non-voting observers to service organisations to listen in and sit in on every meeting, I think is rather interesting. But that's already happening, has been happening, and people are under enormous pressure to comply. Well, the government had already had the ability to terminate or change funding agreements. They've just made absolutely sure that there's no mistake about what they're able to do. Whether or not we happen to be in breach of our funding conditions or not, with or without our consent, and those powers and rights are there as of today. It means that our community organisations are incredibly vulnerable. Pornography and the computer audits. I don't think anybody was particularly opposed to the notion of trying to control access to pornography or the dissemination of it, but however, in this great haste of wanting to ban what is already legally available material, I think the federal government forgot to have a look at, you know, the sorts of programs that are quite often screened on SBS late at night. I would have thought perhaps controlling that might have been more of an issue. Anyway, we'll see. The requirements to conduct these audits and to maintain a register and develop policies and all of this stuff, I mean, again, it's just another layer of administrative burden for anybody that's ever worked out bush or in any of our, you know, community organisations. You would know what the administrative and the reporting burdens are already like. So here's another sort of layer of it, which is just mind-boggling. But that it also means that, you know, the requirement to report stuff to the Australian Crime Commission, I mean, I just find extraordinary. I thought the Crime Commission's purpose was to investigate, you know, major national crime, serious crime. I mean, this is a joke. Yeah, the income management regime. I mean, this is a bit like a Demtel ad, I'll tell you. You know, every time you go to the next screen and it's kind of like, and there's more. Well, there is more. Because I just ran through this stuff very quickly in Alice Springs last week for people in town who didn't really understand how all of this was going to work. But people were absolutely shocked and horrified. It didn't just extend to social security recipients. It includes people like students on AB study. This is, you know, students. It includes the Defence Service pensions as well. And for people like Jeff Shaw, for anybody that knows Jeffrey Shaw, I mean, Jeff Shaw would have to be one of the most decorated soldiers in the Northern Territory. He served four terms overseas with the Defence Force. He lives in Mount Nancy, which is one of the town camps. His income is going to be quarantined. I mean, it's pretty shocking stuff that people can be treated like this. Not on the basis that he's neglected his kids or that he's abused anybody or that he's done anything else wrong. Staggering. I mean, he didn't actually believe me when I first told him. I had to go and get the legislation and show it to him because he kept saying to me, no, they can't do this to me. I'm on a veteran's pension. That's mine. I'm not on Social Security. Yeah, well, hello, Jeffrey. They're coming for you, honey. So, yeah, that was a bit of a shock and a great revelation to him. But I think it's deeply disturbing. So, yeah, 50% of everybody's money in a prescribed community will be compulsorily managed for a period of 12 months. But the other thing is that you have no right of appeal to the external review processes that are normally available to anybody and everybody. We will, however, be graciously allowed internal review only. I mean, you'd have to again ask why. So for 12 months, half of all income support and family assistance payments will be income managed. This is currently being rolled out in four communities as I speak. They're at Amumpa, Mutajulu, Docker River. Yeah, I can't remember the other one. It's all a bit of a blur at the moment. But anyway, the way that this stuff is also being done is it seems to be sort of being managed on the run. But the downside of this is, and I mean, even if you thought for 1 minute that this was a reasonable thing to do, what it does is it's actually had restricted people's ability to go into town to shop. So, for example, communities that are in reasonably close proximity to Alice Springs or Katherine or Darwin, where you could come into town to do your shopping, it meant that you weren't going to be able to do that. We hear at late of last week that you'll now be able to use your vouchers at Woolworths. Well, okay, they've fixed that little loophole, but we still haven't fixed it in Tennant Creek, where you don't have a Woolworths or a Coles. So I'm not sure who's been talking to the food barn there, who's the only supermarket in town. The interesting note here, and I'm sorry if I'm sounding really sarcastic and hostile, I am. I can't help it, I'm just all a bit over it at the moment. But the fact that the minister or his delegate has the power to exempt people from these arrangements just smacks like, you know, the old days of the dog tag. I mean, what's the basis and the grounds and the criteria on which people are going to be deemed to be able to apply for an exemption? And as is simply at the minister's discretion, it seems to be the case. Baby bonuses or any other lump sum payments will be quarantined 100%. CDP. This is work for the Dole programs. And again, you know, we've been talking about the need to reform CDP for a long time. But now what we know is that CDP is to be phased out. This has got nothing to do with moving people into real jobs. Many CDP organisations and participants actually perform what I would describe as being real work, even though people don't seem to believe it, but they do. Some auditing that we've done around CDP participants, almost 40% of people on CDP work 38 hours or more per week. So you'd have to say, well, maybe what we should have been doing is reforming CDEP and instead of calling it CDEP, actually fund them properly and turn them into full paid positions. this again is being rolled out. But I think the point to be made here is that the reason and the rationale for moving people off CDEP to work for the Dole has nothing to do with jobs, as I say. It was purely and simply as a mechanism to control people's money. We understand that the advice that the Australian Government had received was that they couldn't quarantine CDEP income because it was people's wages. So instead of leaving people on CDEP, we're now moving them all across to work for the Dole. CDEP organisations are now being encouraged to become STEP providers. I won't go into all of the complexity of it, but the point is, if governments were serious about this stuff, then there were other things that could have and should have been done which would have been much more effective. The other thing that all of this sort of pie-in-the-sky dream-on stuff about moving people into real jobs and real work is that there's been no acknowledgement of the kind of barriers that Aboriginal people out bush have in terms of accessing either the labour market or being able to engage full-time in real work. I mean, language barrier is one, but the other thing is, for many people, they're not going to leave their country. I mean, we fought too hard and too long to get back our land. Do they seriously believe that people are going to pack up and move into town permanently? They're not. People have been incredibly creative at trying to use CDEP as a way of sustaining themselves, their communities and their organisations to stay on country. Things like the Land and Sea Rangers programs, caring for country. There's a whole lot of work that's being done at the moment about coastal surveillance and quarantine work, all of which is done on CDEP. So why would you use $88 million to quarantine their money and to micromanage their financial affairs? Why couldn't that money have been invested in paying those positions as proper full-time work instead of work for the Dole or being seen as not being real work? I mean, this is lunacy. It's also very clear that a lot of people, because they work those extra hours and they get what's called top-up, people actually get the equivalent of almost, you know, a reasonable income, maybe about $28,000, $30,000 a year. Those top-up payments will continue for a period of 6 months while this is all in transition, and after that, that top-up money cuts out. So what you're going to end up with is people who will ostensibly end up worse off. They will be poorer than they currently are. It will cause additional financial hardship. Community stores. I find this approach, again, really fascinating. The community stores are to be licensed. And if you think about licensing, on the face of it, it might seem like a reasonable thing in trying to ensure a quality of service and that, you know, fruit and vegetables are available at a decent price and so on. I can understand and accept that, but if you think about it, for every other industry, whether it's in real estate, insurance companies, car salesmen, the people that are licensed to operate are the individual traders, if you like, or the dealers themselves. In this case, why haven't we actually licensed the store managers and make sure that they come from an appropriate retail background and hold them individually accountable, as opposed to a community-owned enterprise, which is the store? It's meant to sort of provide a regime, I suppose, that will manage this income management. But in fact, what will happen is that, you know, we've spent the last 20 years trying to get people off book up, which is where, because you've run out of money during the week, you go to the shop, you put it on the tab and it comes out of your pay the next week. Well, this is the way that this income management regime will work in remote community stores. The stores will be asked to carry the cash flow, if you like. So if Centrelink doesn't get around to processing these payments in a hurry, I'd suggest most of our community stores are going to go bankrupt. Those stores are marginal at best, you know, in terms of their economic viability. I don't think there's any appreciation for the difficulty in running a remote community business, much less a community store. You don't have the economies of scale, you have high freight and transport costs. We have pretty crappy, you know, infrastructure in our stores, the fridges, freezers and so on and the like. I mean, anyway, so the minister can take over the stores if he thinks they're not doing a good job. Well, maybe they should. This is just about the end of my presentation, but basically the government sort of argues that these laws aren't racially discriminatory. That even if they are, then the Racial Discrimination Act and the NTA Anti-Discrimination Act won't apply, and that these are special measures. But I'd argue very strongly that we wouldn't see them as special measures. We don't see them as being for our benefit. We don't actually give our consent, never have done, never would, to a regime like this. But most importantly, I cannot see a single thing in any of this stuff that goes to the heart of child protection. Not a single thing. I mean, if they were honest and they were serious about wanting to protect kids, then where are the monies and the programs for things like refuges, child protection workers, family, you know, programs that support and strengthen families. There isn't any of that. And what's more, when you read through the legislation, the word child and children does not appear at all. So it's a joke. I mean, the final point that I would make in finishing up here is I think it's absolutely inconceivable that the federal government could have crafted this very complex and detailed interrelated legislation in the space of 6 weeks. I don't believe that for 1 minute. I think, you know, the tabling of that Anderson Wild report became a very convenient trigger, if you like, and a smokescreen for the government to move on this stuff. I mean, it's pretty clear to me. Okay, thanks. How do you get out of there? Oh. I hope you didn't want that, Sarah.
No, somebody activated over there, I think.
Thank you, Olga, and I'm sure that we've been more informed in that presentation about what's happening in the ground, in the territory, on the ground, the territory, than we have in a lot of other media reports that we've heard. And I think the real challenge is for the media to come on board and start to ask some of the more probing questions and start to dig in a bit further. There's been some good articles around, but there's a need for a lot more. So can I ask us again to acknowledge Olga's presentation? Thank you.